belongingtoyourself.org.
I'm here with Dr. William Keeping, and he's the author of Belonging to God, Spirituality, Science, and a Universal Path of Divine Love. Dr. Keeping is a mathematical physicist and a longtime contemplative on the path of love, of divine love. And we're talking about non-dualism and dualism. And is there anything that you'd like to add to that?
I just want to say that in my researches on this, I came across the term for surrender in the Hindu tradition, prapati or sharanagati, which is relatively little known. I noticed in the commentaries on the Gita, for example, and the Upanishads by most of the kind of familiar sources, I didn't see any reference to this. But then I found a beautiful articulation of the path of divine love by Ramana Maharshi himself, who is regarded as the master of Advaita Vedanta, and who most Buddhists respect as having reached a similar stage of realization as the highest Buddhist masters. But listen to what Ramana Maharshi says now about the path of love. He says, take the case of bhakti, the path of love. I approach the Lord and pray to be absorbed in Him. I then surrender myself in faith and by concentration. What remains afterwards? In place of the original I, perfect self-surrender leaves a residuum of God in which the I is lost. This is the highest form of devotion, parabhakti, he says. Surrender, or the height of vairagya. The I casts off the illusion of I and yet remains as I. Such is the paradox of self-realization. The realized do not see any contradiction in it.
The major word in all of that, too, and especially for Westerners, is the word surrender.
This is the key, yes.
That's a toughie, to surrender. So tell us, what advice do you have for surrendering? I mean, that's...
Surrender is a difficult one for the West, and it's associated with concepts of humiliation and defeat. And the actual process of surrender is articulated very beautifully in the Hindu tradition of Vaishnavite Hinduism, Ramanuja, who was born about 1,000 years ago. And he identifies 5 or 6 stages to the process. And what I found in my studies with these stages of surrender are there in all of the theistic traditions. So I lay that out in my book. But the essence of surrender needs to be understood more as unconditional consent, that one lays oneself in humility at the feet of the supreme reality, whether we call it God or Dharmakaya, and one allows that supreme reality to do its work on one's inner being. This is what it really means. It's not only not a defeat or a humiliation, it's actually simply the recognition that I, as a human soul, am incapable of realizing full enlightenment of with my own resources. I am incapable of realizing the fullness of divine love through my human faculties, and so I offer them up and allow the divine to do its work on me. And don't get in the way of that inner process.
Okay, that brings up, if I'm inviting that in, then there's something separate from me or something uncovered in me, something veiled in me.
Yes, this is important. This is part of the stages of the realization. The first stage of realization is the realization that there's something greater. Whatever it is we call it, greater sense of consciousness, greater being, there is an other. And we then realize that we want to be in relation to this other because that other is foundational to life. But then as we go through the process, we come to a very radical realization that we are that other and that ultimately there is no other. And that we were that other all along.
That just reminds me of the T.S. Eliot poem at the end of his Four Quartets, you know, and I arrive at the place where I started yes. and see it for the first time. I'm quoting it incorrectly, but that's the essence of it, and really recognize it for the first time. So it's kind of like arriving home again where you always were.
That's correct, but with a vastly expanded awareness of who you are now that wasn't there before. The awareness wasn't there, but the ontological identity was there.
So that goes into, that really takes us into some science. Because in you being a scientist, in your background, you have brought forth some ideas of how science also supports this idea of consciousness, and you talk about fractals, and you bring up, as we said in the very beginning of the conversation, the work of David Bohm. And I'd love for you to help us understand how science then plays a part in this understanding.
Well, the Western scientific tradition has, as we know, developed a very powerful method for investigating the nature of reality. And actually, that method applies to spiritual inquiry. If you look at the greatest mystics, they had a kind of scientific rigor about them. They wanted independent verification. They checked things out carefully. They didn't just take an intuition to be true without really rigorously testing it with their peers, which is exactly what scientists do in their peer-reviewed journals. So the basic process of scientific inquiry, I think, applies in the mystical journey. What has happened is that some of the assumptions of the materialistic worldview that have gotten strengthened in the Western scientific tradition have gotten in the way.
That only matter and energy exist.
That's
and
right.
Nothing beyond that.
That's correct. Matter and energy are the two constituents. And one of the great contributions of David Bohm was that he went into the depths of that dialogue with those spiritual masters. And then he came up with a theory that included all of science, but expanded it to include consciousness. And he called this the implicate order. So the implicate order is the invisible realm, essentially the spiritual realm. And then the explicate order is the matter-energy interactions that are a subject of normal science. And what Bohm showed was that these two are part of a larger seamless whole. And he also showed that this is consistent with even the very mathematics of the foundational equation of quantum mechanics, the Schrödinger equation. And Bohm showed how that equation essentially necessitates something that he called the implicate order. Now, and then he came up with this very beautiful statement that a hidden order may be present in what appears to be random. And this is really important because when science comes across something that we don't understand and we see no pattern there, we label it random, we describe it statistically, but we assume there's no deeper order there, because we can't see it. And what Bohm says, no, there may be much more subtle levels of order that we're not able to see with our current scientific instrumentation, but they may be there nonetheless. And with that understanding, he was able to open science into a whole vast realm of the spiritual subtle levels. And this, I think, is really an important breakthrough.
So are different scientists adhering to this and studying this and expanding on this and deepening this?
Well, it's interesting that Bohm, his theory was largely rejected in the flow of the politics of science, if you will. And back in the 30s, John von Neumann, mathematician, sort of proved that kind of theory couldn't work. But then in 1952, Bohm found that his proof was wrong. But by that point, everyone had gone for von Neumann's proof was mistaken.
That
the Bohm-type theories couldn't work. And Bohm found an error in his proof. But by that point, the whole Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics had taken root, which basically said that a statistical description of reality is the most that we can ever know about reality. And they therefore imputed this randomness to nature itself. Bohm and Einstein objected to that. They said that could be just our ignorance. Doesn't mean that reality itself is statistical. It just means that our ignorance enables us not to know anything deeper than this. So what happened was, And then John Bell came along with Bell's theorem in the 60s. He was inspired by Bohm's work. And so to make
What was his theory?
Well, he had this whole idea of Bell's theorem, and he's the one who developed essentially the foundation for quantum entanglement, which says that everything is fundamentally interconnected to everything else. And if you have two photons or two electrons of opposite spin on different opposite sides of the universe, and you measure one, you immediately know the spin state of the other, even though it's, you know, many light years away.
Or so, if you change the spin state of that one, it simultaneously changes
it on the other. It determines the spin state of the other one. That's
determines,
correct.
Right.
And so this was what, so that led
that
to
was
this
a spooky
spooky action at a distance, which Einstein also objected to. But what's happened is that part has been validated, that that shows a fundamental interconnectedness of the entire universe. But what's very interesting now is that Bohm's work is getting a revival. It's experiencing a revival. And one thing that's leading to that is that they are observing quantum mechanical behavior in certain fluid dynamic systems. Quantum mechanic behavior normally has been understood to only take place at very small scales. But a group of researchers at MIT and elsewhere have actually found certain quantum mechanical behavior in macroscopic fluid dynamic systems.
All right, like macroscopic, like galaxies? Is that
no, no, no. I'm talking about just a system in the laboratory of oil droplets bouncing on water.
Okay, so that's a macro rather than the atomic level.
That's right, rather than the atomic level. And so there's a whole revival of interest in Bohm's understanding. Now, this is mostly on his quantum mechanical understanding, but what I'm very enthused by is that I think this will also lead to a revival of his interest and Bohm's whole understanding of the implicate order and the way that he saw that the spiritual realm and the material realm are part of a seamless larger unity, which he called the holo movement.
In the holo movement, there, what does this have to do with consciousness then?
So what it has to do with the holo part is refers to holographic or a hologram, which is a part of special case of the mathematics of fractals. And here I think there's a very important parallel with mystical consciousness. And a fractal is a mathematical structure that's something like a set of Russian dolls. You know how you have a Russian doll and you open it up and you find a littler one and you keep opening and you keep getting smaller and smaller ones, but they each look like the original. They're really miniature versions of the original. And a fractal is a recent discovery just in the last 25 years or so of certain mathematical structures where you have a certain a figure, and then embedded within it, you have these miniature replicas that go down to millions of times smaller, and yet they each tiny one embedded within it has the exact same level of complexity and structure as the original.
We'll talk more about that fascinating information in just one moment. I'm here with Dr. William Keeping. He's the author of Belonging to God, Spirituality, Science, and a Universal Path of Divine Love. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Dr. William Keeping, and he's a mathematical physicist and a longtime contemplative. And his newest book is called Belonging to God, Spirituality, Science, and a Universal Path of Divine Love. And Will, we're talking about fractal science and the discovery of fractals. And you also have looked at how this is spoken about by the mystics as well. I mean, it's come, some mystics have come at this from a wholly different point of view.
Yes. Fractals are found throughout nature. We see them in coastlines. We see them in galaxies. We have, for example, neurons in the brain have a similar structure to galaxies. There are these self-similar patterns across nature. And what I'm speaking to in this book is proposing that consciousness itself has this same structure. So, for example, Rumi says this beautiful thing. He says that the secret turning in your heart is the entire universe turning. So here Rumi is speaking to a property of fractal consciousness, that in the depths of your heart, there is a process which is identical with the entire universal process.
I just want to say about that, because I went to a talk by you, and you showed up on the screen a picture of 100,000 galaxies, the movement of 100,000 galaxies that was able to be done in a computerized version.
That's right.
And then you overlaid that picture with the human heart, and it was amazing here, the movement of our galaxies that we are part of, that the Milky Way is just a tiny little speck of, is the same as our own personal human heart.
Yes, that's a very striking discovery that was just made in the last couple years, was published 2 years ago, and it's called Laniakea, which refers to our local supercluster, which consists of 100,000 galaxies, and it's 520 million light years across. And what they have discovered for the first time by combining data from all these different telescopes is that they've seen the trajectory of these galaxies, and they are basically converging on a structure that looks very much like a gigantic cosmic heart. And this was published in the scientific journal Nature. So it's a very striking metaphorical illustration. But what I'm actually speaking to is something even more glorious, because even that is still limited to the local supercluster. And what I'm saying, for example, as Meister Eckhart said, he said, when God gifts himself, of course, he's using the male gender, and we know that God is beyond gender. But he says, when God gives himself to the devotee, he pours all of himself, all of his beauty, all of his wisdom, all of his divinity, all of his infinity into the heart of the devotee. Now, that is the very claim that Jesus made. He said, everything I have is yours. Everything you have is mine. Jesus is claiming everything that God has is his. How can this be? This is why the mystics were basically, you know, executed as blasphemous. The same thing happened to Al-Halaj, the great Sufi mystic who proclaimed An al-Haq, I am the supreme reality. He was executed for the same reason Jesus was. Because all those around him could not possibly understand this as anything other than the most extreme hubris. But what we understand from fractal consciousness is that they're speaking the literal truth. The full infinity of the divine consciousness can be fully instantiated in the depths of the human being if consciousness is structured in this fractal way, because the miniature version of the whole contains the entire infinite complexity and richness of the original. So the microcosm profoundly replicates the macrocosm.
You've used the term God a lot in this conversation, and when you use that, some people will recoil from the idea of God because we hold this limited view. And I'd like for you to say, when you use that term, what are you saying? What does it mean to you? What is it symbolizing for you?
For me, it symbolizes the supreme source of all that exists, or the ultimate reality, that the ultimate nature of what is, that is responsible for creating all that, that is. So you could also use God if you want to be a bit cutesy, if you believe in evolution and that the only source of creation is random chance, then you could use it as an acronym, which would be the generalized operating dice, G-O-D, that are rolled in each moment of cosmic evolution. Even then, you still belong to God, because were it not for those dice, you wouldn't exist. Or if you're a Buddhist, you could use it to mean grand omnipotent Dharmakaya, G-O-D. You don't have to anthropomorphize it into a gigantic living being. But there is this supreme reality, and the linguistic construct that we have for it, we need some term, whether it's Dharmakaya or the Tao that cannot be named, or God. But God is understood really as the supreme, infinite, incomprehensible, uncompounded source of all that is. And one last thing about that, that one of my mentors, Father Thomas Keating, convened a group of religious leaders from all the major world religions over a 30-year period at his monastery. And they came up with 8 principles that defined essentially a universal definition for God and the process of the spiritual transformative journey. And those 8 principles are in the book. So that's how I understand God. And those principles are spoken of without mentioning the G-O-D word. But they are really the principles of the human, the depth of the human soul. And the essence of it is the depth of the human soul is one with this supreme reality.
So in the one with this supreme reality, can it also be personal? You know, I mean, then that feels like, oh, okay, that it's all this, it's so big that it no longer is personal. Can you say something about that?
Well, this is where I think it's very much can be personal. And this to me is the great, profound, supreme intimacy of the theistic traditions. Because the personal God, the personal dimension of this supreme reality relates directly to the inmost depths of the human heart. And so, for example, Jesus speaks about this when he refers to God as Abba. This is like a personal beloved. Even when he's on the cross and he says, Father, Abba, why hast thou forsaken me? He's begging to a very direct connection that he has with this supreme being. In the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, who's been speaking about God in all these different ways, drops all of the third person and speaks directly to Arjuna in the second person, and says, you know, you are my beloved, Arjuna. Make me your beloved, and you will come into me, and we will have this incredible, profound intimacy as you become me. This is a very profound personal intimacy from the supreme being. And Arjuna, God has already described who he really is. He says, I am the divinity that exists throughout all of manifestation, and exists throughout all of non-manifestation, and is higher than both, yet dwells and inheres in all of it. That is who I am. And you and I can become one through the power of love. It's an unbelievably beautiful promise of union, of supreme intimacy with the infinite absolute.
Wow, it's breathtaking. I mean, I can feel the power of that. And I know that one of the metaphors that you've used and you in divine love is about the fire of divine love, the transformative light that never changes, that it cannot be altered, and that's available. Can you say something about the fire here before we close out this conversation?
Yes, to me, the fire of love in the heart is the absolute key, that it has to be ignited. And that this we do through our spiritual practices. And what happens is, as that fire burns, it attracts, of course, what does fire do? It brings warmth and it brings light and it burns away everything that stands in its way. And so what happens is that fire in the heart attracts the divine fire in the source, and the two fires become one fire. And that is the unity. The unity happens in the union of the fire of the heart with the fire in the heart of God. And then the different religions are all but different colors of flame in the one fire. You know, you have different flames. You have blue flame and yellow flame and red flame, but they're all fire. And I see the different traditions as basically all different flames in that one fire of total radical transformation, in which the depths of the human heart is united through its fire into the fire of the supreme.
So in this way, whatever our tradition that we feel called to, we can go to this deep, deep wisdom, these deep waters, and pull down this fire, that's available to us.
That, I believe, is available to every human heart. And I also think it's essential. When the practices don't work, when someone practices for years in a sort of empty or dry ritualism and doesn't get anywhere, it's because that fire in the heart has not been ignited and engaged. It's that fire in the heart that has the capacity to burn through our limitations and that also draws down, if you will, the divine fire.
So may we all be able to draw down that divine fire in our hearts is my prayer. I want to thank you so much, Will, for being with us today on New Dimensions.
Thank you, Justine, and may we all indeed unite with that divine fire. Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Dr. William Keeping. He spells his last name K-E-E-P-I-N. William Keeping, and he's the author of Belonging to God, Spirituality, Science, and the Universal Path of Divine Love. If you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, thepathofdivinelove.org, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3599.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the Donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org, or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support, and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Larry Brilliant, author of my memoir, Sometimes Brilliant. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about God, smallpox, and India.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.